Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Celebrating 6 years is radio's small business superhero. He's a syndicated radio host, syndicated columnist, author of two books, and all-around nice guy.
He's everywhere! He's everywhere!
The most fantastic crime fighter the world has ever known.
He's Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate.
We're back. 34 after. Thanks very much for being part of our day. I'm excited about Bert Folsom being back on the show. Bert's one of my favorite members of our brain trust. He's the historian in residence at the Small Business Advocate Show, and in our brain trust, he's a outstanding professor at Hillsdale College in beautiful downtown Hillsdale, Michigan. He's our good friend. Bert Folsom, welcome back.
Thanks, Jim. It's always good to be back and talk with you.
It's good to have you back, and as you know, the president delivered his State of the Union speech last night.
And, he did.
To the nation and really to the world. I've asked Bert to join us to talk with us a little bit about the history of the State of the Union speech and really how it's come to be and how it's morphed over the years. And I'm going to read something here, Bert, and then I'll let you respond to it. Far as I can tell, folks, right out of the Constitution. Bert will know more about exactly where this is found, but here's the quote. The president shall, from time to time, give to Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. It is in the Constitution. Here's where it's found. Article 2, Section 3 of the U.S.
Right,
Constitution.
Right, it's Article 2.
Yeah. And so
right.
It's prescribed by the Constitution, isn't it?
It is. Except notice that wasn't necessarily annual. It was from time to time.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So the first one, of course, was on President Washington gave his first one. 1790 something. I've forgotten when it was. You probably know that, Bert.
Yeah. Of course, he took office in 1789. He didn't even arrive in Washington, by the way, until a month and a half after Congress had been adjourned.
Right. Exactly.
Or had been in session, rather.
And he actually gave his first State of the Union speech. Which they didn't call it that in those days, but actually, he gave the first speech in New York, didn't he?
Yes, because we met in New York. That's where the first government was set.
Right, exactly.
Then we moved to Philadelphia before we moved to Washington.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And so he gave his first speech, and what do we know about that speech?
Well, he had his first speech of major import was given in front of the Senate, and there were all sorts of complications with that, and so he quit doing that. And as I'm sure you know, a lot of the speeches as they developed in the 1800s were not read before Congress.
Well, in fact, and we can thank Thomas Jefferson for that, can't we?
Right. Jefferson was apparently a good writer, of course, and a good intellectual.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable sometimes speaking in public, although very good in face-to-face, that kind of thing.
Well, I also read that he felt like delivering the speech before Congress was a little too kingly. And that was one of the reasons, that was another reason why he didn't like doing it.
Yeah. I think that affected Washington a little bit too, but in any case, you're right. In the 1800s, we developed this idea that you would not have this executive with his regal bearing delivering a national speech.
So he was, basically, Jefferson was the first one, it seems to me, who just basically wrote his State of the Union speech and delivered it to Congress.
Right.
And it was done that way then for a long time, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, it was in the 20th century that we had some serious changes made.
I think it was President Wilson was the first one to actually revive the delivering of the speech in person in 1913.
Right. Wilson did, and we were saying at Coolidge, of course, then we get into the media aspect of it,
right,
where it's not just before Congress, but where you have a national audience,
right,
with Coolidge delivering it for a radio audience.
10 years later, in 1923, he delivered it for a radio, and would you not say that that could be seen as maybe the beginning of making Washington a little more of a of a world power seat at that time?
Well, yes.
Would that be too much of a stretch to say that?
No, I think when that happens, that's a fair assessment. Interestingly enough, that of course that's 80 years ago. Tax cuts were on Coolidge's agenda, and they were mentioned yesterday too.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 80 years of continuity there.
Exactly. And you know, the reason I'm saying that is if you've read David Brinkley's book Washington Goes to War, which is a wonderful story about what a sleepy southern town Washington was before World War II. But the truth is that, you know, when Calvin Coolidge gave his speech on radio, that was available, you know, to a lot of different people that had never heard a president speak about these matters. And I'm going to say that kind of got the ball kicked off to making Washington become a pretty important part of the world. Stand by, Bert. We're going to take a quick break. It's 20 till. We'll be right back with our good friend, Bert Folsom. Back at 17 till, I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Let me remind you, coming up in this show straight ahead, we've got Jonathan Zook is going to join us. And Jonathan attended the Consumer Electronic Show in Las Vegas a week or so ago, and we've asked him to join us to talk to us about some of the gadgets, some of the technology, cool things that he saw out in at the CES show. And he's going to join us to talk about that. And then after that, we'll have Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And that's coming up in our show straight ahead. We're visiting with our good friend Bert Folsom, the small business advocate, historian in residence. He's also in his day job, though, where he makes a living. He's a professor of history at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Bert, and we're talking with Bert about the State of the Union speech, a little bit of the history of it and for the United States. And I just think it's important to note the year 1923, when Calvin Coolidge gave the first annual president's address to Congress on the radio, and ever since then, I guess they've been doing that on the radio, been including it on the radio, and then Truman did it on television,
right?
And really, as technology has spread around the world, the President Bush's speech yesterday, Bert, basically became an international address, didn't it?
Yes, and with the Internet now and with the improvement in communications, I think that's a fair statement. It's an international address, and it's one of the few presidents of any country who can command, at least for this attention on this particular day, one day a year, for an international address.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were reports following the speech about how this played in other parts of the world, and basically the general consensus was that not too many people were paying attention. And, you know, and if you think about it, you know, on the one hand, we do lay our business out there, you know, for people to see all over the world, and I think it's a good thing for other people in other parts of the world to see the way we conduct our government business. But at the same time, we're not too interested in what goes on in the Japanese parliament, or
right.
You know, and even though, since I don't have a life, I'm often seen on C-SPAN or some of those other channels watching the House of Commons you know, go through some of their paces. I think that's interesting, but basically we don't pay attention to what the other guys are doing. So, you know, a lot of them don't pay attention to us, but it's still good, I think, Bert, that we're able to show people how a free and democratic society works.
Well, yes. The major addresses that have been most effective that presidents have given, I'm thinking, say, Washington's farewell address or Lincoln's second inaugural or even the Gettysburg address, have hit on a theme that have tried to define what we are about as a country. And, you know, Washington talked about avoid entangling alliances, avoid the party spirit,
mm-hmm.
kind of give us general advice, or Lincoln talking with the Gettysburg Address, reminding people of the sacrifices that were made at Gettysburg. It's evolved, though, in the 20th century and even today to kind of given the active role of government now to a satisfy different constituencies by popping in different programs and different suggestions for different groups. And I think that's sad, but it reflects the changes in the nature of the way we view government changes since Coolidge was president.
Well, and you know, one of the things, talking about historic speeches, one of those that just really inspired me was Washington's farewell speech.
Right.
Where he gave us the name American. He basically, I don't remember the exact quote, I've got it here somewhere, but he said, we are Americans.
Right.
And he gave us a charter. He charged us with that and told us to be true to ourselves. And that was, even though it wasn't the State of the Union, his farewell address was, folks, if you ever get a chance to read it, it's worth the time.
It is, and I like what you say. It involves trying to elevate the country to a higher level, to have us achieve. It defines our values, our characters, to help us achieve higher goals. Whereas most times, State of the Union now, as I say, is just satisfying different constituencies.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things in the speech I thought were very good, like the tax cuts and talking against marriage penalties and estate mm-hmm. taxes, and the possibility of health savings accounts and Social Security. Having private accounts for that. Some of that is good, but, you know, a lot of it, job training and this sort of thing, mm-hmm. is just trying to satisfy different constituencies.
Well, but another thing, though, that I was proud of Mr. Bush for is he drew a line in the sand. He laid down the gauntlet with people who think that, they have a chance to defeat us, because he said, you know what, we won't ask permission to defend ourselves. We will defend
yes.
ourselves. I, as the president, he said, I will defend America to the best of my ability, and we won't ask permission. We don't have to ask anybody's permission to defend ourselves. Well, I've forgotten exactly what he called it, the word,
yes.
the term he used, but that's essentially what he said. And,
yes, it was.
And, I'm impressed with him saying that, because that tells people, I mean, there are millions and millions of Americans who appreciated him saying that.
That was a good point and is very valid. It will be hard to assess his foreign policy for another decade or two, but nonetheless, what he did there was very good. He did draw in the sand, as you say, some things that America is, some things that it is not, and I thought that was very appropriate.
One of the things, we're going to take a quick break, folks, in a second. And when we do, when we come back, Mr. Bush made a reference to an entity, a higher power, a number of times in his speech, that more than I think I've ever heard before. I'm going to get Bert to weigh in on that issue right after these messages. It's 10 till. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Here's ZZ Top to take us out. We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with our good friend Bert Folsom, who's a history professor at Hillsdale College, Hillsdale, Michigan. And Bert, you want to give us a website for your college there?
www.hillsdale.edu.
Hillsdale.edu. And
you'll get our website there, and Hillsdale takes no federal funds. One of the only colleges in the country that does that, and therefore we are not subject to various types of federal regulation that everybody else is.
Very interesting. Very
an independent college.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't even know that doesn't even know that existed.
Bert, right.
One of the things that Mr. Bush did last night that I thought was very interesting, and I noticed it when he first did it, but then what really became noticeable was how often he mentioned God in his speech.
Yes,
and not only did he mention it in terms of referencing where we get our strength, and I've forgotten exactly how he said it, but he also brought up policy with regard to religion, with regard to the government being involved in with faith-based institutions and helping them with their activities. Now, tell me, this is a little bit his reference of God in the State of the Union speech was kind of noteworthy, wasn't it?
Well, Bush is a Christian, and he made that clear in the 2000 campaign, and that it's an important part of his life and an important part of the way he thinks, and very likely an important part of his success. Yes, it's not politically correct to do that, But that is what he is, and he's not afraid to say, this is what I am, and that's it.
Now, so is this a good thing, do you think? Do you think it's a good thing that we should be able to stand up and say who we are and how we feel, as long as we don't, you know, as long as we don't impose that on others, I guess, or minimize other, like you said, you called him a Christian, as long as
right.
he obviously doesn't try to proselyte or diminish, you know, other religions. Of course, he mentioned other faiths in his speech as well.
Yeah, he did. With Bush, it's genuine. We have a lot of presidential candidates from time to time posturing mm-hmm. because they think that with voters that will play well. But with Bush, it's actually sincere. He actually is a believer, and his statements there are a reflection and an outgrowth of the beliefs he has. Therefore, when he was talking about the Defense of Marriage Act or some of his faith-based initiatives, those are policy outcomes that are reflections of his faith.
Do you think that's what people like about George Bush, that whether they agree with his policies or not, they believe that when they look at him, they're getting WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get?
Well, I think so, and I think especially after the last president, that's very important with people, that there's a sense that this guy has high character, and whether you agree with him or you don't agree with him, you're getting someone who is a person of presidential caliber, who is a sincere person, and who is genuinely trying to be an honest and effective president.
And isn't that kind of a politician pretty tough to beat?
Well, it is. It is.
Ronald Reagan was in that mode, wasn't he?
He did that too because he also was a believer. He was not as intense in his beliefs as Bush is, but they both were believers. And of course, Carter was too. I mean, the Democrats mm-hmm. have had genuine Christians in there before too in recent history.
Well, and of course, I'm not just mean. I don't just mean religious. I mean just in terms of convictions, having the courage of his convictions.
Yes. Well, that's it. Bush would argue, I'm sure he says, my belief in God helps give me an assurance that I'm working to fulfill some things that he would want to do and that God is helping me do this, and it makes my job a lot easier, and I want to do the right thing and be pleasing to God.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, but that makes some people uncomfortable, Bert.
Well, it does, and one of the things that it plays out on some of these faith-based initiatives, Bush seems to think sometimes that if something is good in society, that what we need to do is we need to have the government get behind it, and
yeah.
it'll be better.
At least get out of its way.
But right, if it gets out of its way, it often will be better. Rather,
yeah,
but
exactly.
We've seen so many industries that have been subsidized and ruined because of the subsidies that I'm concerned that he may, if he's not careful, we may achieve counterproductive results by backing faith-based groups where the federal funds come in and prove to be to unravel the group rather than help the group.
And that's
right.
Why sometimes you see people who are against you know, the government being involved in that, who are actually religious people, because they really would rather that we don't need. I think their attitude is, we don't need your help. We just don't need you to hurt us either.
Well, that's the key thing, and there's so many people trying to harm Christian groups that if Bush could just remove those harmful influences, that would be
of course,
a positive.
And not just Christian, but any kind of faith-based groups.
Sure.
Bert, thank you for being here. Good job today. Well done.
Jim, thanks.
We'll do it again real soon. Bert Folsom, ladies and gentlemen, he'll be back. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blasingame. I'll see you later.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.